listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Syria's army has advanced against ISIS up to the Iraqi border, as the country's military is pushing the remaining terrorists out. Despite the fact that ISIS is almost gone, however, U.S. forces don't seem to have a plan to withdraw. RT's Jacqueline Vuga has more.
ISIL has been losing territory in Syria at breakneck speed, and its all-out defeat looks to be on the horizon. Even the U.S. seems to agree on that front.
Secretary Tillerson has engaged a great deal of sort of personal diplomacy on Syria, the defeat of ISIS, and now that ISIS, in terms of as a physical caliphate, will be gone by the end of the year.
Syria has, in fact, already declared victory over ISIL and issued a warning to the U.S. that it's high time they left as well. And that shouldn't be a problem, given that Trump himself has said that America's interest in Syria is reserved to fighting Islamic State.
We have very little to do with Syria other than killing ISIS.
So, theoretically, if ISIL only has a couple of months left, then so does the U.S. presence in Syria, right? Don't hold your breath. The U.S. Secretary of Defense James Mattis recently hinted at what the U.S. will need to see before they leave. Mattis says U.S. soldiers have a right to be in Syria despite Damascus's objections.
The U.N. said that ISIS, basically, we can go after ISIS, and we're there to take them out. But that doesn't mean we just walk away and let ISIS 2.0 pop back around.
But that remark about the UN isn't 100% true. The U.S. does not have a UN mandate to deploy, let alone station troops, in Syria. A UN Security Council resolution only authorized sanctions to be used against ISIL, such as freezing assets or an arms embargo. But nowhere is troop deployment to a sovereign country mentioned. And the Syrian Democratic Forces, one of the groups who the U.S. backs and who happens to be at odds with Damascus, have welcomed America's long-term plan for Syria.
They have a strategy for decades to come. There will be military, economic and political agreements in the long term between the leadership of the northern areas and the US administration.
So while ISIL is on its way out, all signs point to the Pentagon digging in.
We spoke with a former UK ambassador to Syria. He was also the former UK ambassador to neighboring Bahrain. His name is Peter Ford, and we spoke with him via Skype from London Saturday. Peter, a pleasure to have you on. For the first time in 5 or 6 years, I won't say I'm optimistic about the situation for the people there, but it certainly looks better than it did a year ago.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's no thanks to my country, the UK, or to yours.
Or mine, yeah, right.
Or anybody in the West. In fact, right. All we have done is manage to put spokes in the wheel and delay the ultimate success of the pesky Ruskies and the Syrian government forces against ISIS. They're now involved in basically mopping up operations. There is still one town right on the border with Iraq to be cleared out. And the ISIS people, many of them have just gone underground, shaven off their beards and melted back into the general population.
Yeah, right.
I'm sure we will be hearing more from them. But as an organized fighting force, it looks like curtains by the end of the year.
Yeah, that's the way it seems. And that's more or less what President Putin stated the other day, that it's, we're in the mop-up at the end stage. Then, of course, there's a tremendous amount of damage. I mean, the word doesn't do justice to what's been done to Syria, the physical plant, the buildings and all of that, and the people and the society and the culture and everything. Once the killing and the bombing and everything stops, now you have the task of, addressing all of that as well ahead of us.
Absolutely. Although if you take the long view of history, you will see that Syria has seen one disaster after another, whether it's earthquakes or whether it's man-made, the Crusades or the fight for independence in the 1940s. But the destruction on the scale of the last 6 years is absolutely immense. Having said that, I'm relatively optimistic. Bear in mind that Syria is largely an agricultural country, and fortunately, most of the fields have not been blown up. And I would expect the agriculture sector to be the first to get back on its feet. Much will depend on how quickly the exiles can return, and I would expect the Syrian government to give them inducements, get back those millions of people just across the border in Turkey, in Lebanon, and in Jordan.
Yeah, just for our listeners' benefit, you did a stint as ambassador from the UK to Syria, 2003, 2006 is what the bio I'm looking at says.
Right.
Also to Bahrain. And so you have a sense, obviously, of the government-to-government contacts. We have this, war that's been declared on, and one of... let's destroy it, turn it into what they did to Libya. In the aftermath of that, so the war ends, hopefully soon. The task of reconstruction begins. Syria, the UK, the US, Russia, Iran, Saudi, all these countries are still, on the stage, and they have to deal with each other. What kind of challenges do you think, say, the UK is going to face, going forward in, dealing with the aftermath?
I've been saying for 5 years that all these countries just need to butt out. That includes my country, the US, the Iranians, and the Russians. If the Syrians had been left to sort out their own problems, it would all have been over much, much more quickly. But we are where we are, and these outside players continue to play an important role. Realistically, what matters most now is that Russia and Iran continue to stand alongside the Assad government, which they almost certainly will, and they will ensure that government's survival against all odds. So, in fact, that is now virtually a foregone conclusion. But the outsiders, my country, the US, Saudi, are outside the tent pissing in, I'm sorry to say, trying to hamper reconstruction, trying to... they're stalking Assad. All this nonsense about use of chemical weapons, most of the nonsense about atrocities, it's just stalking and sour grapes, because they back the losers in the shape of the Syrian opposition. They believed wrongly that there were many thousands of moderates out there. These proved to be just phantasms. The only folks out there who were fighting Assad were jihadis.
Yep. Yeah, the you know, it's interesting that you frame it that way as well. The United States, for example, over the period of the 6 years or whatever since February of 2011, almost 7 years, has dropped. Here's $10 billion. We're going to go recruit some more moderate rebels, and only to find that the 500 moderate rebels or 1,000 moderate rebels that they were supposedly training and arming or whatever evaporated into thin air, and suddenly the weapons ended up in the hands of jihadis. New group, old group, or as Mark Sloboda says, one of the 57 varieties of jihadis. That's kind of been happening a lot in these different regime change operations that the U.S. has. We saw the narrative that was applied to Libya, for example, certainly cannot be applied to explain the conditions on the ground in Libya now. Clearly, what they said was happening wasn't, and instead, what many of us were saying was happening at the time, and people inside Libya were saying, is that you had foreign jihadis that were coming into Libya, backed by the U.S. and U.K. and French Air Force, that conquered the country, in essence. They were killing black Libyans, calling them mercenaries. They were destroying the place, and, you know, it was an invasion and not an uprising. Same in Syria, more or less, although there was maybe a larger indigenous component to it.
Yeah, that's right. I'm afraid the Pentagon generals and their acolytes in London and Paris and elsewhere could never see a hornet's nest anywhere without wanting to give it a good kick.
Yeah.
and see what happened, with predictable results. We had it first with the support for the Taliban. Remember that one? That didn't end very well.
Yep.
And as you mentioned, Libya, then we got rid of Saddam and just blew the powder keg there. There was no jihadi terrorism in Iraq until we went in there. And similarly, we made the situation much worse in that respect by trying to topple Assad.
Yeah, and also the other thing that their big fear is now in geopolitical terms is of a Shiite crescent and a Shia crescent, and there was really no consideration in any deep sense of Sunni Shia, et cetera, in the geopolitics of the region until the U.S. created the situation, and what they did was take what was in essence a Sunni state that was allied with the United States and turned it into a Shia state that's allied with the revolutionary government in Iran that was the big enemy number one, you know, only 35 years ago.
Exactly. When you look at actual results of U.S. Military initiatives, or rather adventures, you see that they've all backfired. Iran was the main beneficiary in Iraq. Iran is one of the main beneficiaries now over Syria, and stands to be a main beneficiary over Yemen. Plus, recently, President Trump took sides with Saudi Arabia against Qatar. And guess what? Qatar is now getting into bed with Iran.
Oops. Yes, it's true. I mean, there are a number of other things. I don't think we've yet seen the manifestation of what the potential of this thing here. But even though the Saudis and the Israelis have been allies and have had allied interests for many years, this has always been under the covers. And, you know, with, I guess you'd say plausible, but in any event, deniability. And suddenly conditions have reached a point where they are now openly discussing, you know, this fact that they are allied. In fact, the implications of that are pretty interesting on the ground there, with particularly among some of the fundamentalists that have been spawned by the Saudis.
That's right. The interesting thing is that most of the fundamentalists are not interested in Israel at all. Yeah. And they, in fact, they have literally trampled on the Palestinian flag. Yeah. They don't like Palestinian nationalism or any other Arab nationalism. They want just the Ummah, the Arab or the Islamic nation, or all brothers together, no individual states. You know, the caliphate was supposed to expand indefinitely across the Islamic world. So they're no supporters of the Palestinians, and they don't care very much about the Jews. It's not part of their rhetoric. They're much more focused on schisms, as they see it within Islam, essentially on fighting the Shia.
Sounds a lot like the American and European left.
Don't want to go there.
Yeah. But it's another religion, perhaps. The situation in the region includes, what's developed in Bahrain since the so-called Arab Spring, which in essence was a peaceful, popular, widespread uprising, a genuine one, an indigenous one, a spontaneous one in many ways, and essentially the suppression of that by Saudi Arabia and occupation by the Saudis, and all of this in a country where, I don't know, half the real estate is a U.S. naval base.
Exactly. The double standards of the West were blatant. We love to see secular strongmen toppled, Saddam. Well, when the Arab Spring got going, it was the president of Tunisia, it was Gaddafi, it was Mubarak, it was going to be Assad. You know, we never saw a secular leader, an anti-Islamist leader that we didn't want to overthrow. Whereas when it came to the kings and the little kings of the Gulf, wow, they could get away with blue murder.
Yeah. And in Saudi Arabia now, there's been very volatile political situation. Given the conditions that people face there in the 21st century, moving forward into the 14th in political culture, there's always a sort of a latent potential for an immediate release of political energy. But you're seeing things that are really volatile now, and I'm wondering what you think the implications of that are for the for the region.
Well, I think I need to reread my copy of The Godfather before I say very much, because that is exactly what's going on. It's just clans and mafiosi and capos. We have a new capo on the block in Mohammed bin Salman, and it's family members against other family members. Yeah, it's the Godfather. Not only just at the level of Saudi Arabia, but almost the whole of Middle East politics could be read in terms of mafia activity.
Yeah, I wonder who's going to end up playing Mo Green in that scenario. another interesting development, though, in the midst of all of that, all of the palace intrigue there and the purges and such, was a visit by Salman to Moscow. It's not unprecedented, but unusual and sort of a... we're all oil-producing countries. Let's start to coordinate our policy some kind of discussions coming out of both Russia and Saudi Arabia. And that at the same time, by the way, that Russia is picking up, essentially shoring up the debt of Venezuela, another large oil producer. I'm wondering if oil politics are going to sort of present and as well the realignment, or in any event, the change relations between Turkey and Russia, the improvement relations, and some of that over a pipeline. If all of the economic issues and the potential, alliances for oil are going to have an impact on changes, basically, in the geopolitical situation there.
I think all the players are agreeable to compartmentalizing their oil policy and their military security policies. So Saudi is ready to cooperate with Russia on the oil price and with anybody else. And this has no bearing whatever on how they're going to behave in Syria or with regard to Iran or whatever. And bottom line is that these countries know they have to live, and the oil price is absolutely crucial to them.
Yeah. And it's interesting, though, because there are some sort of drag-alongs that go with that. On the one hand, the Saudis may decide we are going to be, on the side of the U.S. as against Russia in general or in this or that geopolitical struggle. On the other hand, one of the weapons that... the U.S. has used against Russia and also against Venezuela was tanking the oil prices, tanking commodity prices generally. And if you have the Saudis less, they're also less able because of what's happened to their own economy over that, but less inclined to play some of those games, there's an impact on the geopolitical situation, even, despite the intents of the parties, let's say.
Yeah, but don't forget, Don, it's not very long ago that tensions were high between the U.S. and Saudi over shale.
Yeah.
And it appeared at one moment that the U.S. was ramping up on shale to do down the Saudis. But again, personally, I think this was compartmentalization. The U.S. had its shale policy for its own particular reasons, nothing much to do with relations with Saudi Arabia.
Right. And then there's so many contradictions, because on the one hand, in order to make the shale competitive, you would need to drive up the oil prices from, the Russia, Venezuela, particularly Saudi Arabia. And for other geopolitical considerations, they actually drove them down, which made shale not competitive at all, and more or less chilled that whole, explosion that was taking place in that business.
Yeah. It's ironic that Saudi and Russia share this interest in driving up the oil price. In fact, Russia stands to be the biggest beneficiary.
Yeah, that's true. Let's see. What do you think is going to present as maybe the next... conflict in that area with all of the moving parts? They're trying to coalesce a political situation in Libya. You could see even at the UN yesterday or the day before the discussions about that there's a lot to do just in terms of preparatory work before anything actually gets done there. Of course, in Syria, we had what happened at the UN yesterday, the U.S. And Russia on opposite sides of the question of, there's still, U.S. is still trying to stir this whole thing over chemical weapons, basically, which seems pointless. Also, Yemen, the U.S. has sort of backed off of Syria. It's allowing the development of what's developed there to occur without too much interference. It's different than it was with Obama, for certain. And likewise with Yemen, those spots that were bombed, you know, where the U.S. participated in bombing in Yemen directly, as opposed to the AWACS assistance and everything to the Saudis, they actually bombed Al-Qaeda instead of bombing, quote-unquote, Houthis, in other words, Yemenis. So what do you think is like... There's a lot of moving parts. What do you think is going to start presenting, say, in 2018, like for the next phase?
The one to watch is U.S. relations with Iran, which might come to a head in Lebanon. I'm not predicting that. In fact, I think on the whole, it's likely that we'll escape a major crisis over that. But that has the capacity to go very badly wrong, as it did in 2006, when Lebanon was devastated by a war launched by Israel, which ended in a stalemate. The Israelis didn't even secure any of their hoped-for gains, but it's been followed by 11 years of peace on Israel's northern border. The Galilee has never had such a sustained period of peace, and why is that? Because Hezbollah, whether we like them or not, have held the ring in Lebanon and literally prevented Sunni jihadis lobbing Katyusha rockets across the border at Israel. And there's been the stability that comes from mutual deterrence. And it's this stability which risks being upset by the Pentagon general's policy towards Iran, and the egging on of Israel into rash acts. But if I may come back, Don, to the issue you raised earlier about the Syria and chemical weapons and the vote in New York.
Yes.
Forgive me if I go into a little bit of detail
here.
No,
please do.
It's very interesting.
Yes.
When you read the report done by the international inspectors into the incidents of April earlier this year, it's fascinating reading because it raises as many questions as it answers. Now, the inspectors came to the conclusion that it was Syria what did it. But if you go to the trouble of reading the 68 pages of the report and you have half a brain, you will not come to that conclusion, but you'll have to have your wits about you and know a little bit about what's going on and reach at least section 77 of Annex 2, which is fascinating. It shows that there were 248 cases reported to hospital, right? Of those, 57 reported before the alleged incident even happened. and 10 of those cases presented in hospitals 80 miles away.
Whoa.
Now, you know, maybe in some parallel universe, it's possible.
Sounds like a Star Trek episode, yeah.
But, you know, you don't have to be Sherlock Holmes to work out that something fishy going on here, and this story just doesn't stack up.
Yeah, I mean, this is the essence. This is the essence of the disagreement between the U.S. and Russia: is the methodology that was applied and the chain of custody of the materials that were being examined. Like, where did this stuff come from? Well, we don't know.
Exactly. Well, we do know it came from the
Turks, bad guys, right? Yeah, right.
Who have their own biases and came from Idlib, the province of Idlib, which is in jihadi hands.
Right.
So you're sort of believing Al-Qaeda over everybody else.
Right. And by the way, an act of faith on top of it with Al-Qaeda that, okay, let's say they're telling the truth about where this came from. There's still gaps from here's the material to here's the conclusion. And just the whole methodology is ridiculous.
Exactly. The inspectors, again, on a point of detail, they lay great store by the fact that the sarin samples that they got hold of had the signature of those in the Syrian government chemical weapon stocks, which were 96% destroyed, according to other UN inspectors. Now, the missing 4%, guess where that was? That was in rebel-held areas that the UN wasn't able to inspect.
Right.
And one of those areas was, yeah, you guessed it, near the place where the alleged attack took place.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting to see how the inconsistent presentation from the U.S. side and at the U.N., at the Security Council, and from the U.S.'s allies. If you go back to that plane that was shot down, the jetliner that was shot down over Ukraine back, you know, a few years back, people, the local militias had said, why don't you guys come here and inspect the site? Come take, you know, look at the, everything on the ground. There, we don't have to do that. We don't need to come there. You know, here, you know, you're not allowed to go. Under normal conditions, a forensic study would be, okay, these are samples that you collected. Fine, we're going to take those. We're going to the site. You go to the site as soon as possible, assuming that those who were involved are going to try to, you know, manipulate the evidence, you know, mess around with it. It's going to naturally decay and et cetera, et cetera. And instead, an opposite, the game looks like they're hiding something.
Exactly. That's just what happened in the case of Syria. The inspectors didn't want to visit the site of the incident itself, and they delayed visiting the airport from which the Syrian military aircraft took off.
Yep. Yeah, so, well, we're going to have to keep an eye on this and see how it develops. Unfortunately, for the Syrian people and for humanity generally, it's not over yet. Fortunately, it appears that it's close to being over, and I think that's a good thing, and we can only hope that we're not going to see this kind of craziness break out again, although I'm not hopeful on that point. Peter, thank you very much for your time and for
My
all
pleasure,
the work
Don.
That you do. Thank you.
Anytime.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Germany's president, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, says his country is facing a situation not seen in 70 years. Merkel's party is at a crossroads after negotiations to form a coalition government failed. Steinmeier's urged all sides to form a coalition and not let down voters who cast their ballots in September's election.
We are now confronted by a situation that's not existed in the history of the German Federal Republic for 70 years. This is a moment when all sides need to take stock and reconsider their conduct. All parties elected to the Bundestag have a shared duty to serve their country. I expect from all parties a willingness to make possible the formation of a government in the foreseeable future. Those who seek democratically given responsibility mustn't shirk away when they hold it in their hands.
The German president made his statement following the failure of coalition talks between Angela Merkel's CDU party and the Free Democrats. The Free Democrats walked out of the talks because of opposing views on several key issues. One stumbling block is the migrant issue, in particular whether to limit the number of asylum seekers and whether to allow their family members to reunite with them. RT's Peter Oliver has more on the unfolding crisis.
Well, the reason those coalition talks broke down was because Christian Lindner, the head of the Free Democratic Party, pro-business liberal party here in Germany, he walked out of those talks. He did also give a statement on Monday saying that as he'd done that, it wasn't a decision he made lightly. But as we can hear from him, just after he walked out of those talks, it certainly doesn't seem like he was coming to an agreement with anybody in that room anytime soon.
We will not abandon our voters for a policy with which we are not convinced. It is better not to govern than to govern badly.
Well, the Green Party, for their side, who are also part of this negotiation that was going on, they've said that at the time the Free Democrats walked out, they were close to a deal that, in their words, would have been an improvement for refugees, and say that didn't get signed because the Free Democrats walked out. But what about the other big player in German politics, the Social Democrats? There was a chance they could come back in, form a coalition with Angela Merkel, as they had done before the election, and everything would be fine. Well, their leader and former European Parliament President Martin Schulz has spoken to the cameras. He said there will be no grand coalition, as it's known, with Angela Merkel. He did say that if there were fresh elections, that he would consider running again against Angela Merkel. And in terms of the options that were available, one option, apart from fresh elections, is a minority government with Angela Merkel as its head. He said that simply wasn't the right move for Germany, considering how weak it would make the government and what role Germany has to play on the world stage. So where does this leave us? Either a coalition deal gets done, a minority government is allowed to rule the Bundestag, or we all go back for new elections that would probably take place early next year or in the spring at the latest.
Well, someone who might be able to shed more light on the situation now is Mr. Frank Elby, a senior FDP party member and former ambassador. Thank you for joining us on the programme, sir. Now, the president is calling for fresh negotiations. How likely is it that they will lead to anything new, do you think?
Well, at the present, I think that the coalition talks aiming at a Jamaica coalition have definitely failed. That does not exclude negotiations with all responsible parties concerned to consider some sort of cooperation, either by tolerating a minority government or by even forming some sort of coalition government that might eventually work.
Mr. Elby, why did your party walk out of negotiations? What were the main sticking points there?
Well, my party has, right from the beginning, said that we are guided by principles. We have been elected because we were committed to modernize the country. We entered into these negotiations with good faith, and things went well in the first phase of the coalition talks. We then ran into difficulties, and the main obstacle was caused by the Greens, who unfortunately introduced a decade-old conflict between Realos and Fundis into the talks. And it was this conflict between the Greens themselves that never allowed to achieve a meaningful result. I think that was the main stumbling block. And there was one point when we realized that the chances to have a Jamaica coalition would not really stand a fair chance anymore. But then something happened in the last night that relate to the problem of the soli, which is a special tax that was introduced in Germany after reunification, and which means that all German taxpayers have to pay a certain amount of money for the reconstruction of the former GDR. Mm. Now, the Free Democrats wanted to abandon this tax, and there was a stumbling block all of a sudden established, and against promises that we had had from the CDU before, this was no longer an option for us. And I think that caused some anger in the last minute of the negotiations.
Well, the Greens have said they're more than ready to negotiate. They're eager, in fact. Do you think your party, the FDP, might change its tune?
The point is, when the Greens say that they are eager to act, they would have to prove it. They are split on the issue.
Do you think that a minority
My party would actually, I'm not speaking for the party, I'm just an old senior member. My party, I think, would be willing to resume talks if there is a meaningful outcome.
Do you think that a minority government could be on the cards now? And if so, what would that mean for Chancellor Merkel?
Well, you know, it depends if Chancellor Merkel would still be the candidate for the chancellorship. It is the president who is, according to our constitution, the person to suggest a candidate. Now, this cannot be taken for granted that it will be Mrs. Merkel. I understand that there is a strong opposition in our own party against being nominated if the coalition with the Jamaica partners would fail.
We've spoken to a few analysts throughout the day who've said that this could be the beginning of the end for Angela Merkel and her party. Is that a view that you share?
Oh, yes, indeed.
And how likely is it, you think, that there'll be snap elections held in Germany?
That is a matter for the president to decide. If a new chancellor would be elected, even as a head of a minority government, which would be possible in the third phase of the elections, where the relative majority would be enough, it's still his decision whether he is wishing to tolerate a minority government or whether he would call snap elections.
If this is, as you think it could be, the end of Merkel's party and her time as the chancellor, how do you see her future?
I must tell you, I have never really thought about it.
Okay, let's turn to Martin Schulz, shall we? The SDP's Martin Schulz, he's ruled out forming a coalition. Why do you think he's done that?
Well, you know, I think that the Social Democrats have virtually suffered a lot in two grand coalitions that they have been going through with the Christian Democrats. And they didn't gain anything from being in a great coalition. Therefore, I think it is the bitter experience that they have made, an experience which was also shared as a coalition partner when the Free Democrats until 2013. I think it is this bitter experience that has prompted such a reaction. Not to be enthusiastic about one more, it would have been the third round of grand coalition. And I tell you quite frankly, I think that the grand coalition is perverting democracy.
Do you think that later this week we'll see all parties return to the negotiating table, yes or no?
Well, I think it will not necessarily be a return to a negotiating table, but they have their own channels to communicate with each other and to investigate if there are proper means to return to a negotiating table in the final analysis. For the time being, I don't think that the same people will meet again within the next few days.
Mr. Frank Elby, senior FDP party member and former ambassador, thank you for sharing your thoughts and shedding some light on the situation there in Germany. Thank you.
Meanwhile, Germany appears to be preparing for a different course in its foreign policy. Here, RT interviewed Germany's foreign minister, Sigmar Gabriel.
Mr. Gabriel, thank you for taking the time to sit down with us.
Well, it's our second interview.
Thank you. Can we take it as a step towards a détente between Germany and Russia?
The fact that I'm giving you an interview? No, I think we should get accustomed to having more media outlets covering German politics. We also communicate with Turkish channels and newspapers. In Germany, many people watch Russian channels, so of course we should pay some attention to them to make sure German policies are expressed in their content. I'm convinced that we do need a new détente with Russia, despite some of the very complicated disputes over Crimea and the situation in Ukraine. We cannot tackle global problems without working with Russia.
Is that an acknowledgement that the world has become multipolar?
For Germans, that's not news.
Really?
Yes, it's true. If you think of the Iraq War, Back then, we said we would not play any part in it because we believed the US was wrong. We have always been in favor of a multipolar setup.
What about Syria? It's all a bit different there.
Why? That's probably the clearest example of why we need to work with many countries that stand against Islamic State and its allies, including terrorists arriving from Iraq. Russia undoubtedly has a position that is different to that of the EU or Germany when it comes to many of today's issues. And it's the same with China. The US also builds relations with countries that hold views which are not in line with their own. It's more about looking at what divides us and what brings us together, and whether these are areas where, despite our differences of opinion, we can achieve better results if we work together. And with Russia, of course, we have many opportunities.
Regarding Ukraine, you said that if the UN peacekeepers work successfully in Ukraine and the ceasefire is observed in accordance with the Minsk agreements, it could become possible to start lifting the sanctions. Does that contradict the US position, or do they support you?
I think this is the right approach, and there is nothing new here. My predecessor, Frank-Walter Steinmeier, who is now the German president, held the same view. The conflict over Ukraine and Crimea is a major problem. In the 1970s, we signed a vital treaty in Europe. We committed to respecting national borders and to never launching an intervention in a neighboring country. For Germany to be a respected partner, we had to acknowledge the existing border with Poland. And we said, yes, we do. And without that treaty, there would have been no reunification of Germany. We have treaties that say we cannot intervene in a neighboring country, but Russia did that, and we see this as a very serious violation of international law.
Do you mean east of Ukraine or Crimea?
Crimea, and of course the conflict in eastern Ukraine, which Russia is involved in. Russia is also involved in the four-party format with Ukraine, Germany and France, aimed at finding a solution to the problem. Despite their differences and despite the conflict, I believe that we can all work towards a new détente. Willy Brandt, former German Chancellor from the Social Democratic Party of Germany, started the détente with the USSR in the darkest hours of the Cold War, when troops entered Prague. I think we need a new vision for peaceful coexistence in Europe. Look at North Korea and what is happening there. If the US, China, Europe and Russia do not work together, we will not be able to solve such problems.
He's not a madman, but it is difficult to establish a dialogue when all we've been hearing for so long is that he really is one.
I think that is a false assessment. We have to look at what was happening before when he seemed to have a clear strategy. He decided, if I get nuclear weapons, no one can bring me down. That's why we should first ensure the security of North Korea. It's not about regime change or military intervention. I actually like the suggestion that the US Secretary of State put forward. North Korea's nuclear program could encourage others to follow suit, and we could end up with a very dangerous world. Our children will live in a world more dangerous than the one we have today. Other countries may say, look, it's actually possible. To put an end to this threat, we need cooperation, first and foremost between Russia, the US and China. And we Europeans can also play an important role in that. Germany is part of this when we say that we want to support the Russians, Americans and Chinese.
As for Europe, you told Handelsblatt that Europe should be focused on foreign issues. I assume you mean that it is time to have a new foreign policy, whereas before Europe was more inwardly focused. What does Europe stand for? What are its values and interests?
The truth is that in foreign affairs, both are important. What makes Germany different is that we used to put our interests to one side so as not to jeopardize our values.
How does that correspond with the German arms trade policy?
Are you sure this is a question for me?
Yes, because you're saying we need to have more respect for values than interests. And that makes me wonder, where are our values when we sell arms to autocratic states like Saudi Arabia?
What do we sell them?
Arms.
What kind of arms?
The regular kind.
What makes you say that? We are not doing that. We have cut most of our arms trade with Saudi Arabia.
But we used to.
Yes, in the past. But when the Social Democratic Party gained power, the trade went down. For example, I put a stop to Merkel's plan to manufacture 250,000 German assault rifles in Saudi Arabia, and the plan didn't go through. But if you ask me to choose between values and interests, we obviously need to find a balance. Germany has its interests, but we don't want to get to the point where we sacrifice our values, freedom, democracy, human rights, peaceful coexistence of nations, for economic interests. But our foreign policy is guided by both values and interests. You asked me about Europe, and you are right. Europe is focused on domestic affairs. It was important after World War II, in order to make sure that a new war did not happen and maintain peace. and Europe needs to have its own voice in global affairs. In the past, we have often said that global politics are what the Americans do. If something goes wrong, we will complain. But I think we need to find our own voice. We have partners and allies, including the US. But we are a continent that needs to make sure it is not just an appendage of someone else's foreign policy. We have our own interests, and we need to represent our citizens in the world. And it's in our best interest to make sure that there is no arms build-up in Europe. There is so little trust between Russia and the US that we are at a point where the disarmament treaties signed in the 1980s are greatly threatened.
The 2% goal is still being discussed. The Chancellor wants to reach that goal, if I understand correctly. But the SDP wants to move in a different direction. How will the situation develop if the Social Democratic Party of Germany does not get to play a significant role in the government?
That's why we keep saying that those who want Germany to stay a peaceful nation, those who support a policy of de-escalation, should vote for our party, which in my opinion is the only possible choice in this situation. Unfortunately, Angela Merkel and some other political players, such as the FDP, plan to double Germany's defense budget.
But if the current status quo...
Let me finish my thought.
Of course, I'm sorry.
Doubling defense spending means that Germany will spend over 70 billion euros per year on weapons. France, as a nuclear power, gets by with just 40 billion euros. The entire federal budget is only 300 billion. Where will we find money for education, aid for developing countries, and infrastructure if we listen to Donald Trump and spend all this money on defense?
President Obama also wanted this.
No, NATO never decided that 2% of GDP should be spent on defense. Somehow this argument between Merkel and Trump made it sound like we owe something to someone. But we don't have to do this. I think it is a false idea. There will be fewer wars and refugees in Africa when the residents of those countries get more opportunities. So helping and investing in developing countries will bring more peace than doubling Germany's defense budget. The Social Democratic Party will not let that happen.
Since you called Germany a peaceful nation, I want to talk some more about the arms trade. How can we be the number three or four, this number varies, weapons exporter? We sell a lot of weapons abroad. I don't think this qualifies us as a peaceful nation.
We have made a lot of money selling weapons this past year. For example, we sold 4 tanker aircraft to the UK. We do not pretend that we don't need the armed forces. I think that both German and NATO forces must be adequately equipped, but that is quite different from scaling up. Frankly, selling 4 tanker aircraft to the UK does not threaten global peace and security and does not suggest that Germany is not a peaceful nation. It is nonsense.
But this amount and 4 tanker aircrafts?
It's one of the reasons why the amount was so high. You have to understand one thing. You can have large amounts and no major problems, and on the contrary, sometimes smaller amounts can cause bigger problems.
Can you give an example?
Small arms. Small arms used in civil wars all over the world. Not tanks, not aircraft, but handguns, machine guns, RPGs. We pressured the current government into lowering the export of small arms. For example, now nobody is allowed to manufacture German small arms abroad. I'm the last person to say that we don't need to be able to defend ourselves. I just think that we need to monitor what is being manufactured and sold. In my opinion, there should be more cooperation with Europe. Even if we reach the mark of 50% of the US budget but are only 15% efficient, it would be pointless. And it's all because each country does its own thing.
Do you support the idea of an EU army?
I think that at this point it is not a very realistic idea. But we try to achieve the same goals without cooperation, wasting money. And that doesn't make sense. Cooperation would make sense, but I can explain what I mean by peaceful nation. Germany needs to raise the issue of using monitoring mechanisms that are not working right now. We need to discuss disarmament. We have to keep the current treaties between the US, or NATO, and Russia, like the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. It is a great treaty signed by Reagan and Gorbachev. It is still valid, but is being threatened. Germany's role is to make sure that the Iran nuclear deal doesn't fall apart. Also, I think we should look for mechanisms that will allow us to rebuild the European security architecture, as the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe tried to do. It doesn't seem realistic right now because of the major conflict with Russia. But on the other hand, Vladimir Putin recently made a proposal that we need to take seriously. He basically said, let's send the UN blue helmets to Ukraine. We might disagree on the particulars of the mission, but it would be insane not to sit at the negotiating table to discuss the idea and its implementation. If we're able to achieve a truce as a result of the UN involvement, then I think we will have to start talking about lifting sanctions. Some Europeans think that sanctions should only be lifted when the Minsk agreements are 100% fulfilled, but I don't think it is a realistic approach.
Speaking about the election campaign and an opposition party, you said we'll have Nazis in the Bundestag again. What do you mean by that?
I'm no good at lying. The truth is, AfD leaders are just neo-Nazis. It doesn't mean...
But you...
Please let me finish. It's a very important matter. I'm not saying that all AfD supporters are Nazis, but everyone who votes for them has to know it's led by neo-Nazis. They openly admit it when they say that we need to make a U-turn in how we see our history. What does that mean in terms of the Holocaust, Auschwitz, aggression against other European countries? What does it mean to make a U-turn with our history? Grab what we had back then, what we got under criminals. I have to be honest about how I feel when I come to the Bundestag and see, for the first time since 1945, since the end of World War II, a Nazi taking the floor at the Reichstag. It's depressing. And we need to say this out loud, to say, listen, there are many reasons to be dissatisfied with policies now and then, but thanks to our parents and grandparents, Germany became a great country. Many people came here to use the opportunities created by democracy, freedom, and social security. For many people, we are what America was back in the 19th century. Let's prevent them from ruining the treasure left in our care by our parents and grandparents.
But you know that after Nazism was eradicated, NSDAP members were among the Bundestag lawmakers, and I wonder if you're downplaying that.
The fact that they were members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party does not mean that they promoted Nazi ideology in the parliament.
But they were Nazis.
Right now you are talking to a social democrat whose fellow party members fought with people like the ones you refer to. Our ancestors were sent to concentration camps, prisons, and other penitentiary institutions. Willy Brandt was exposed to libel from former Nazis. Since then, there have been none in our parliament, even the old members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party, who would openly promote Nazi ideas. But it is being done.
It means you see a line between...
I don't draw any lines, I'm just telling you the truth. You have people at the top of the AfD who incite a particular sentiment in other people, who promote Nazi propaganda. Germany has not seen anything like this. This threat ought to be downplayed. What you are doing right now, and please do not hold any grudge against me, is an outrageous disregard to the fact. You cannot really compare the 1960s with...
You seem to treat members of the National Socialist German Workers' Party differently from the Nazis, from the AfD.
The German parliament has never given the floor, either in Bonn or in Berlin, to people who promote Nazi propaganda. I think that will change. Once again, not all members of the AfD and not all of their voters are Nazis, but you have to be aware of the fact that some of the party leaders do have those ideas and they want to encourage other people to act in a particular way. It is not just Alexander Gauland, there are other people who have lived off the state, who get a state pension and are now pitting the people against the government. We know it can happen and it is happening right now. It is outrageous. But there are also people with really dark intentions. It is people who will not work for the peace of our country or Europe. We need to talk about it out loud.
I would like to refer to a quote by Hillary Clinton, who once called half of Trump's voters a, quote, basket of deplorables. Do you have a concern that by talking in this way, you are only mobilizing those people? We saw that in the US, people responded to such statements in the following way. No, it is not true, and I will vote for them anyway.
First of all, I think we need to stop lying that there is no such issue at all. Voters need to act responsibly too. You can't say, I want to live in the country, use the opportunities provided by the democratic system, and then, disappointed by something, vote for politicians who will destroy democracy. Unlike other countries, this nation had prior experience of what could happen if these people become part of society. I've never seen an election campaign like this one before, with so much ferocity, even violence, when members of democratic parties are exposed to verbal and sometimes physical attacks during door-to-door campaigning. The country is in good shape, and we want to keep it that way. We do not want discord and division. Here are my two major points. We must expose the real intentions behind the ideology of people like Björn Höcke, and at the same time talk to our citizens about their concerns. I have always argued that Germany is facing the challenge of a dual integration. We need to help refugees settle down here and at the same time unite people who already live here. You shouldn't create an impression that the authorities are doing everything for one group of people and nothing for the other. I think Angela Merkel made a major mistake when she refused to back the idea of a minimal level of pension benefits. It is something our nation needs. Then I would be able to tell these communities that are seeing a wave of refugees, we will compensate your expenses on refugees and will also provide the same amount for your own residents. We need to pay to improve our schools, healthcare and child protection services so that people do not have a false impression that the authorities have forgotten about them. But there is one thing that we cannot agree on. We cannot downplay the threat of what is happening in the minds and unfortunately hearts of some of the AfD's leadership. This is a dangerous path for the country.
It means there will be no détente policy towards the AfD in the parliament?
There cannot be any détente in our attitude towards Nazis, neo-Nazis and right-wing populists. I cannot allow myself to downplay the threat as you do.
Mr. Gabriel, thank you for your time.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR.